Welcome to the Over the Counter Podcast. I'm Mark Giesecheck.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.
This is episode number 19. In this episode, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of things that you really care about, namely food.
And that's just one thing.
Okay, well, food and water.
Oh, okay, that's two things.
Genetically modified organisms, aka GMOs,
and
Weston Price, and organ meat, and mental illness, and the blood-gut barrier. And the paleo diet and the GAPS diet and rabbit starvation.
And metabolic heritage.
Oh, well, I think we also need to talk about what are going to call it, food production ethics?
Yeah.
Or the ethics of food.
I don't know
science.
If we're going to get to all that.
We have a lot to talk about. That's why we have to get going.
Okay. Mark's cracking the whip on me today.
Well, as you can see, it's necessary. We have a lot of topics to cover.
He's been a whip cracker today.
All right. So, if you haven't read your newspaper, well, if you still get a newspaper, if you haven't read the internet or whatever it is you read to get news in about 10 years, you wouldn't know this. But if you have at all kept up with anything having to do with food and science and GMOs and whatever, you'll notice quite a few things. That lots of foods now that you find at the grocery store have a label that says GMO-free or organic. Mm-hmm. That there have been a lot of people upset about genetically modified organisms, which we tend to eat a lot of, whether it be corn or wheat.
We do. America does.
America does, yeah.
I mean,
in Europe, they're illegal.
In Europe, they're illegal, right.
You might have heard a little bit about the company Monsanto, which to a lot of people is like the big bad Darth Vader of food science.
I was going to go with the devil, but Darth Vader.
And there's a very cuddly relationship between Monsanto and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what's interesting, okay, so what's going to emerge from all of this, and I will try to lay this out at the beginning, which I think is interesting, is that there's a controversy underneath all of this that really is an intellectual one. Okay, mm-hmm. And the controversy runs something like this. On the one hand, you have people saying, gosh, we really shouldn't be messing with the genetics of our food. We shouldn't be disrupting nature and trying to play God with our food. Instead, we should eat everything that's organic, and we should eat grass-fed beef. We should eat things that we were designed for, right? Things that are very natural, and we should stay away from foods that have been messed with by scientists, okay? On the other end of the argument, the other side of the spectrum, you have people like this guy, Norman Borlaug, whose name you might not know, but he won the Nobel Peace Prize, or Nobel Prize in Agriculture, rather. And when did he win that? Sometime
ago. In the past.
In the past. Why? Because he was the guy who came up with what we now refer to, I think, as dwarf red wheat. Which produces twice per year and is disease resistant and high yield. All right,
is it higher in protein as well?
I'm not sure if it's higher in protein,
because I know that they've messed with a lot of modern wheat and made it dramatically higher in protein, and the wheat that's in protein is primarily gluten, and hence some people argue that's the problem with gluten sensitivity is because we've been inundated with these more of it, even but we eat the same piece of bread.
Right. Okay. So basically, on the side of the organic food eating anti-GMO crowd, they have all these arguments against using science to manipulate the food supply. On Norman Borlaug's side, you have this idea of, well, some countries can't feed themselves without advanced food science technology. Mm-hmm. And so this was the argument way back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s that led to the development of a lot of GMO foods was that, well, these countries can't feed themselves. They're going to outrun their agricultural carrying capacity. We need to develop ways for them to produce enough food to feed the people that they have. Mm-hmm. Therefore, that was the ethical justification for introducing rather complicated food science stuff into messing with the agricultural produce of all these countries. And what it did do, right, is it turned some countries, like Mexico, from countries that needed to import food to countries that could export food because they were able to produce that much more.
Yeah, and there's a question, and I think you and I were talking about this the other day, and I think that a good way to look at this is that this is the this is part two. This is the sequel of the original Faustian bargain that happened whenever we stopped hunting and gathering, and we got together and we formed this little thing that you may have noticed we have called civilization. And you said when you can all move together and you can grow stuff and you don't have to like move from place to place, you can have libraries and books.
I think before we can introduce that idea of civilization, the cultivation of grains, I think it's worth asking you what is the paleo diet?
Okay. And why
is it important, and how does it predate civilization?
Okay. So our species, Homo, has been around, I don't know, roughly like 2.5 million years, you know? Homo sapiens, they say roughly, you know, 100, 150,000 years. So everything that isn't something you could kill or pick off a tree or pick off a bush and eat raw, that was food. Everything that isn't that, so we're talking cereal grains as a primary food stuff, dairy, a large scale use of legumes, all this stuff is at best at the most liberal estimate, about a 10,000 year old idea. Now that sounds like 10,000 years old. I mean, that's like way past Bible times or something. That sounds really long to us. But if you took the entire history of man, the history of species Homo, let's say, and you made it into the timeline into a football field, then the last few inches of the last yard would be the last 10,000 years that we've been eating something else. So it just hasn't even shown up on the evolutionary radar.
So basically before ancient Egypt and ancient Sumer, right, and the ancient Minoans and the ancient Chinese and the Indus Valley civilization was a bunch of people who went around killing animals and eating them and then picking some berries along the way.
And eating things seasonally as they and not eating, and more important is not eating all this other stuff, not eating all the sugar, not eating all these grains, not eating dairy, not eating all this stuff. Now, what's interesting is you bring up examples like civilizations, like, for instance, the Egyptians. Okay, perfect example, because we have so many mummies from the different times then, and they're a good example of what you can see in any civilization. You go and you dig up these mummies or whatever from the early primitive agriculture, from when that few generations after they shifted over to agriculture, and you find that they're about a foot shorter, their teeth are rotting out of their heads, they have skin folds in the mummies where you can tell that they were obese, and you go, well, hey, I've seen hieroglyphs, they're all skinny. Well, yeah, so the girls in Vogue, you know, they put the ideal on the wall, right? So these people, and we know that some of the pharaohs had really bad teeth and all this stuff. It's written about in the histories, right? So you go back and you look at the corpses and stuff that they find and the preserved bodies of hunter gatherers from before then. They're a foot taller. They have more muscle mass. They have a big, wide set jaws with a full set of teeth with no cavities in them. They have no signs of hypertension or no kind of calcification of the arteries and all that. So they don't have the diseases of civilization. And also, you can do modern studies in, what do they call those? Epidemiological, but whenever they just go look at people that are alive now, you can go to Papua New Guinea and go look at the Kong, or go look at the people in South America that are actual hunter gatherers now,
right?
And they don't have any of all these things that we're trying to solve, you know, taking Crestor for your heart disease and all that. They don't have any of that. They don't get cancer.
Right.
When was the last time you saw a deer with cancer? Animals, when they're in their natural habitat, eating what the God designed them to eat and living the way they're designed by instinct to live, they don't get cancer and all this weird stuff. And you see that when man, the animal, can be observed in these hunter-gatherer cultures, he doesn't either. So the question is, what are we doing that we didn't used to do that is throwing this whole thing off? And then,
yeah, well, I was just going to introduce a couple other factoids out there.
Now, I was told, I saw today that factoid means it's false. I didn't know that.
All right. I'll just mention a few things.
Yeah, no, I use the word the same way. I saw a list of words you're using wrong earlier today, and that was the only one that I was wrong on. Factoid. Evidently, factoid means it's not true. Sorry.
That's your hack of the day.
There's my hack of the day. I was just like,
all right,
I was blown away by that.
I was just going to mention, lots of people have been very interested in preventing aging, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially as they get older.
Right.
So there have been lots of people written books about cultures where people live a really long time.
Right.
So there was one that came out a few years ago by this guy named Dan Butner, I don't know how you say his name, called The Blue Zones, Nine Lessons for Living Longer from the People Who've Lived the Longest. And he basically went and visited some of these, you know, primitive cultures or whatever, where people still eat traditional diets and try to observe what they were doing and why they don't get cancer, why they don't get heart disease, that kind of stuff. But I think that there are multiple approaches to this. I mean, another really famous one that, if you haven't heard of this guy, you probably should have, right, is Weston Price, who was a dentist in the early 20th century, went around visiting all of these primitive cultures while they were still eating their primitive diets. Mm-hmm. And since he was a dentist, he took pictures of people's teeth and examined what they were eating and how that related to their dental health.
And not just their teeth, their jaw structure was huge for Weston A. Price.
Right.
And jaw structure was a symbol of the overall bone structure, because the ones that have poor nutrition and get like narrower jaws, the women also have narrower hips and a narrower pelvic region where they have more trouble bearing children and stuff. So the human body fleshes out and flourishes and looks, it's shaped the way it was supposed to in these primitive cultures.
And I think in a certain sense, what's so great about the fact that Weston Price did this research is that bones stay around for a while. So you can actually go find ancient bones or medieval bones or whatever and do additional research on, you know, these nutritional questions based on bone structure, which is fascinating, you know, because there's a lot of medical history, if you will, you can't have access to because it's all rotted away, you know, unless it were a mummy or something.
But bone structure doesn't lie.
Right.
If things are misshapen and the ratios between this gap and this size of this bone and all that are not right.
Okay, so an interesting example of this from ancient Near Eastern studies, you know, where I live in my little academic world, is that sometimes they find skeletons and they can tell that they are women because the knees are all worn out and the back is really crooked and worn out, because women would spend, maybe 8 to 16 hours a day grinding grain in a lot of parts of the ancient Near East. So they can tell what era they lived in. So a lot of women for a lot of the period of the ancient Near Eastern history would spend time in their home kneeling on the floor in front of a basically a rectangular stone with grain on top of it, and then with a rolling pin type stone, and they would be rolling the grain, grinding the grain.
That's just amazing.
And then eventually, they developed, more sophisticated grain grinding technology using donkeys and stuff like this.
And then you compare that with...
But this actually sheds light on this biblical story in the Book of Judges, when, I can't remember what her name is, she kills a guy with a millstone.
Yeah.
She throws a millstone out of a second-story window, and all of us are thinking, what? Like, a millstone like the size of a tractor tire? How's she going to pick that up? And it's like, no, it's not really what she's using. She's using one of these home millstones that you would use for personally grinding grain while you're kneeling on your kitchen floor. That's what she was throwing.
And so by the time Jesus makes the reference to a millstone being tied around someone's neck, that's a much bigger object by then, right?
Yes, by then.
Because it would actually make you sink.
Right. And there's the difference between the lower millstone and the upper millstone. So in Hebrew, it's called, the upper millstone is called the chariot millstone because it's the one that moves.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And the lower millstone just sits there. It's like the pavement.
Yeah. Well, and so it's in, yeah. So, well, that, yeah, that, I'm glad we advanced so far to where we could not have hunter-gatherers anymore. Instead, we could spend 16 hours a day on our knees. That was really efficient. But, I mean, it's interesting because
the problem is surviving through winter, right? When things aren't growing and whatever.
It depends on where you live. I mean, if you live in someplace temperate, it's not a problem because there is no winter, right? So, I spent 12 years in California. It's like we have farmers markets year round. I mean, it's nice, right?
Well, no, I mean, but that is something interesting. I mean, I think if you track most of the paleontological, estimations of where human beings migrated, right, that humanity started in Africa and then sort of migrated northward.
Mm-hmm.
Into places like Europe and I guess it would be Western Asia.
And you see the healthiest humans that are obviously are hunter gatherers, the ones that are just crazy healthy, are the ones that live in temperate zones,
right?
And they can have.
Well, what about the Eskimos?
Right. Well, and there's a good example. Eskimos.
Don't they get scurvy or something?
No, that's just it. And the Inuits do not get scurvy. And
other deficiencies?
No, that's just it. It seems
just
like
eat blubber.
Well, first of all, if you eat if you're eating the whole bodies of grass-fed, pastured, real game animals,
yeah,
and you're eating bone marrow, you're eating organ meat, you're eating the brains, you're eating everything, right? Like, you don't waste anything. Like the
like hot dogs.
Like hot dogs, yeah. If you don't waste anything, and it's and that animal has been walking around eating only what God designed it to eat, then the only thing you're not going to get way plenty of, as far as even the recommended daily allowance on the government like pyramid or whatever, is vitamin C. But what's interesting is that cultures where they're all poor and they're eating bunches of rice that we're sending in bags to them, and they're not, they have to get a big booster shot of vitamin C or they get scurvy. The Inuit don't get scurvy. So evidently, when you're not giving your body a bunch of weird carbohydrates that you're not designed for, this high glycemic index carbohydrates, high glycemic load carbohydrates,
yeah,
you process vitamin C better, and you don't need as much vitamin C.
Wait, can we actually make vitamin C with our bodies?
No.
Okay, so you
I don't have think to get I don't. Yeah, outside. I think you have to get it from outside. That's one of them.
So, so there's a little bit in meat.
There's a very small amount left over from the plants that are eaten by the animals, but evidently we don't quote unquote need
so
as much.
If I lived on an all walrus diet, I would be fine.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, the Inuits do it.
Man.
And they eat most of it raw, and they eat...
Wait, you should tell us about rabbit starvation. What's that?
Okay, so, well, that is... Okay, that's a good segue. You want to kill a seal, you want to kill a caribou, you want to kill an animal that was big, with some fat deposits, right? Why? Why do all these hunter-gatherers, the ones in Europe, there's a great... I mean, European hunter-gatherers used to... One of the things they used to hunt was a cave bear. Okay, this cave bear, and with sharp sticks, five, six guys, sharp sticks, cave bear. Let me explain what a cave bear is. Cave bear is about three times the size of a grizzly, okay, and it could gut a grizzly with one swipe. So picture a giant Kodiak, like a big old grizzly, right? This would be like a puppy compared to a cave bear. And they used to kill these things with sharp sticks, right? Why would they do that? Because they need fat. Why do they need fat? Because the old trappers in America used to live off of rabbit, and they would eat only the lean portions of the rabbit for the most part, muscle meat, and they would get too high of a percentage of their calories coming from protein. And so if you get above that 40-45%, for some people in certain circumstances 50%, you know, if you get up in that, you know, nearing half of your calories coming from protein consistently, you're going to get protein toxicity, which they call rabbit starvation, because you could eat as much rabbit, and at some point it was better to eat nothing than to keep eating protein.
What happens when you get rabbit starvation?
I've never had it, obviously.
Do you start getting longer ears?
It's like
fluffy tail.
No, I know it's a gastrointestinal's pretty bad. I mean, diarrhea, stuff like that. It's like it gets ugly. It's a toxin. I mean, it's like you're reacting to a toxin. Basically, your body can't process that much protein without other stuff going on.
Yeah.
So that's why you need...
So it'd be kind of like if you ate corn dogs exclusively.
Kind of, yeah.
Except they have brains
in
them, probably.
No, corn dogs have that corn on the outside. That would get you out of the rabbit starvation. Be bad for you. But, well, good example is like there was a guy...
So if I decided to eat steak for every meal because I'd won the lottery or something?
If you could get away with eating ribeye every meal... Or eating a fatty steak, yeah. Oh, okay. But if you ate like London broil for every meal and nothing else, then you would get rabbit starvation. Or like chicken breast all the time with no carbs or anything. So there was an example of a guy that rode with the Indians out here in Colorado and studied their way of living. And it wasn't –
Was it St. Vrain?
No. Weston A. Price talks about him. I don't think it was Price. I don't think it was Price himself. But he has a story of them, and there's like 12 of them riding together. Right, so just him, an assistant, and like 10 Native Americans. And they would be out riding, going from one place to another. And every day, for these 12 men, they would harvest three elk. They would take three elk. And you're like, an elk is huge, right? But the only part of the elk they would eat was the tongue cooked in the fat that's on that big back fat piece. That's all they would eat, and the rest they'd leave for the wolves. In the Inuit, the Eskimos, right? The part that you and I think is...
I don't know if I really want to eat elk tongue for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Oh, I would eat elk tongue in a heartbeat. But that, like the Inuit, they, we think they would eat the part, okay, the part of the animal that you and I or like most Americans would think is like really, really yummy and good, like the, you know, the loin, you got to, you know, if you like elk loin or something, caribou loin, deer loin, you go to, you know, Whole Foods and pay, you know, $30 a pound for it because it's so lean. It's like the loin, right? That was the part that they leave for the sled dogs.
They eat the fatty stuff.
Yeah, well, it's like...
It's like when I went to a restaurant once and I was like, should I get the regular burger or should I get the lean burger? I asked the waitress and she's like, I don't know about you, but I really like a juicy burger.
Right,
and
right.
And so I got the regular burger, which actually has fat in it.
You know and historically and globally now, the part of the animal that we throw away is the choice part.
Yeah, so, like the lungs and stuff.
Yeah, I mean... You read these accounts. There's a great account, and I think it's in the Michael Eads book, Protein Power, where he talks about, you know, it's like, so they're talking about how they this the, it was an account of, an anthropologist account of them the Aborigines killing a wallaby, and how they cooked it, and he says at one point, and at this point, as always in every primitive culture, a fight broke out about who gets the offal. Because the offal is the good part. And think about this. Homer, right? With he describes the feast after a battle. And the hero's portion was the fat portion set aside. With the vitals all spitted
in. That was the part that would be sacrificed to the gods.
The vital part. The vitals. And he'd say the vitals all spitted and glistening. You know? And then in the Odyssey, when Odysseus comes back and there's all those suitors in his house. And there's that one big alpha male suitor. And he's got his portion set aside that he's going to eat of the thing that they killed to barbecue, and it was I think a stomach filled with blood that had been sitting by the fire roasting. That was the hero's portion.
Yum,
right?
Yum.
Was like the stuff that we consider trash.
Yeah.
Why? It's got all the diverse fatty acids in it. Really, it's got all the flavor in it. You don't believe me? Go down to your local like ghetto taqueria. And order taco de buche. It's fried pork stomach. It's like crunchy on the outside, kind of chewy on the inside. And you put cilantro and onion on it. It's like the best taco on earth. It has so much flavor. But people are like, ew. As if like this part of the animal is made of something different than ever. I mean,
What I was going to ask though is in Greek religion, weren't the fatty portions sacrificed to the gods?
Yeah.
Which is interesting because as a modern reader, you'd be like, oh, so they're giving the gods the bad parts and keeping the nice parts for themselves. When really,
no.
They're giving the gods the good parts.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, and why? Because you need the fat, because especially if you're out on the trail and it's wintertime, you have to kill something big to get fat deposits so you don't get protein toxicity, right? So, yeah, Weston A. Price, you brought him up, right? They asked Weston A. Price at the end of his life, they said, look, you've been all over the world. You've studied all these different people, all these different diets. Some of them eat grains. Some of them don't, all this stuff. You know, look, giraffes eat leaves off of tall trees. Wolves eat other animals. Cows eat grass. What is the human diet? And Weston A. Price said, grease and guts. It's like
great.
Grease and guts. So now how do we go now?
But we have to bring it back to the ethical question.
The ethical question, yeah.
Right, which is this diet, whatever it might be, whether it be the paleo or the Weston A. Price or whatever, is it...
Yeah, because he likes raw milk and stuff, which the paleo people don't really do.
Is it realistic to tell a grain-eating civilization, hey, you guys are doing it all wrong, we all need to go back to grass-fed beef and we need to eat fatty deposits on walruses and stuff, and forget, you know, your Wheaties and your cornflakes.
Well, I mean, there's the problem is
pancakes and whatever else.
Well, the difference is,
here I'm about to eat a gluten laden muffin.
It makes me sick. Just you're doing that right in front of me, you evil person. You, I mean, think about this though. It's like you take two cows, put them side by side from the same stock, and you let one, and they both eat the same grass the whole time. And then you take one of them and you leave it on grass. The other one you put in a feedlot and you give it bunches of corn and soybeans and stuff to try to pump it up and get it really fatty so you can make more money when you sell it and get it fatter faster. Now, at the end of when they'll be slaughtered at different times because it takes it longer to get fattened on grass, right? So let's freeze them and then come back and compare them at the end. So they were... theoretically, both just killed, right? So now we got them. We compare them side by side. The omega-6 to omega-3 ratio is a big key ratio to look at. And that omega-6 fat is going to be like 17 to 1 in the feedlot cow. It's going to be 1 to 1, 2 to 1 in the grass-fed cow, because there's going to be so much more omega-3.
You just went like Star Trek on me. I don't even know what you're talking about.
Omega-6 and omega-3 fats. And one is inflammatory, one's not inflammatory. They're like, and so basically cows, when they eat grass or deer or whatever, they're basically salmon on, they're wild salmon on hooves. The fatty profile, the fat profile is way different than a feedlot animal. So these big, thick corn-fed steaks that we like that taste so good, I don't like the way they taste anymore. I like the taste of grass-fed meat now. But though that fat, even if they're equally marbled, they're the chemicals in that fat are totally different.
I love talking about steak, but we still haven't talked about ethics.
Okay, the ethics.
Right, can everybody in the whole world eat marbled grass-fed steak?
There's the problem. I mean, can we? The true answer is I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of land that I don't see anything being done with in, Wyoming and
Eastern Colorado.
And I mean, when you leave, I'm from Missouri, so I go home on occasion. If my mom's listening, very seldom on occasion, I go back. And but man, part of it is when you drive across Eastern Colorado and Western Kansas, you spend the better part of the day begging God for a tree, just something to break up the monotony.
There are cows out there, right?
Yeah, but there's a lot of farmland. So here's my question. I don't know this. What if in the 1940s, we managed to, before grain subsidies and all that, we managed to feed cows grass. There was less people. But there's a question. Is that
Fewer.
What's that?
That's the grammar Nazi in me coming out.
Okay.
Fewer.
There were fewer people as opposed to less people.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll fight that later. I'm not sure the difference. But
you don't know the difference between less and fewer?
You're the one who used factoid wrong. Anyway.
Well, it's like when you go to the grocery store and they have the speedy checkout lane.
Yeah.
And it should say 15 items or fewer. A lot of them say 15 items or less, but that's wrong. That's incorrect. Because you only use less when you're talking about something like a liquid, something that's continuous, right? But when you're talking about individual items, you have to use the word fewer.
So fewer is discrete.
Right, so you could say, I want less coffee, but you can't say, I want less chairs. You have to say, I want fewer chairs.
You could say, I want less coffee, but not less coffee beans. You want fewer beans.
Exactly.
So fewer is discrete quantity,
yep,
and less is continuous quantity. Yep. Ah, see.
That's your grammar hack of the day.
Two grammar hacks in one day. All right. Woo, look at us. So here's a question, and I just don't know the answer to this. If we weren't growing all that corn to make high fructose corn syrup out of and to feed all of our animals, and we weren't growing all those soybeans, and we weren't growing all the stuff that we're not built to eat, and we did use all that other space, and if we change zoning laws and let more people have chickens and have backyard gardens, and if we changed our culture to where we used our space well and we ate maybe less food but higher quality food, could we, as a country, the first question is, could we as a country all eat paleo or Western, eat a diet ergonomic to our metabolic heritage? I'm prone to say yes, we could. Now, could we do that globally?
That was Andrew's food utopia you just heard about.
Yeah, I mean, could it happen? But I mean, because how hard is it to buy a case of, you and your two neighbors a case of sauerkraut and have a place in one of your garages where you're fermenting your own sauerkraut and getting good probiotics and all that? I mean, it's not that you could do it in the root. People could have root cellars again. People used to have root cellars.
I was just trying to think of starting a grass-fed cattle ranch in Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Sounds
so
kind of difficult.
Obviously, but that argument, all that says is that because we changed the way we eat for the sake of building this thing we like to call civilization, we have moved into places that you couldn't live. Places that are not inhabitable for human life.
Yeah.
And so they have to, but then there's my question, what the heck are they growing in Saudi Arabia? If you can't grow grass-fed beef, you can't grow grain-fed beef either.
I've never been there.
So you could truck in hay just as easy as you could truck in, you know, grains, it's like, seems like. So, I mean, are there places that maybe you just couldn't live without importing food? I mean, there are now. So, I don't know. A lot of this we talked about was...
We also didn't talk about beer, which I think is an important part of this, basically, that a lot of archaeologists are starting to think that the original cultivation of grains that was done in Mesopotamia and the cradle of civilization was done not for the sake of bread, but for the sake of beer.
Well, I mean, it makes more sense to me. If you give me a piece of Wonder Bread or a delicious fat tire, I'm going to go with the fat tire every time.
Well, I don't know. Probably either would kill you.
Well, yeah, it wouldn't kill me, but it would make me not feel too. Actually, fat tire, a guy from New Belgium told me, is probably in the neighborhood of 20 parts per million or less. You know, hopefully they'll kind of adjust it at some point and I'll be able to drink it again. But I can have 20 parts per million or less of gluten in a beer. Wow. Omission, this is a shout out for Omission Pale Ale and Omission IPA. Thank you, Omission. Thank you, Widmer Brewing Company, for making delicious beer that us Glutherans can drink.
Okay, so I don't know if we've really solved any of the crises or answered all of your questions about GMOs and organ meat and Weston Price and food science politics and pasture.
Gosh, are we at the end?
The GAPS diet and the paleo diet and rabbit starvation and cultivated grains and beer and antiquity. However,
we haven't even talked about gut permeability. We haven't talked about Natasha Campbell McBride.
We're just going to have to save food and mental health for another podcast.
We need to have podcasts on gut permeability, probiotics. And it's linked to autism.
Someday,
and all that.
Somehow, we will find our way to talk about mental illness and permeability.
We'll do
but
that next week.
For now, you have heard way too much information about your food and how you may or may not be eating what you should be eating and what you were ergonomically designed for, or whatever that terminology was.
What is ergonomic to your metabolic heritage? What I said.
In case. You
here come the comments where people gripe about me using big words.
In case
okay,
you have not died of rabbit starvation by listening to this podcast, you have now made it to the end of the Over the Counter podcast. I'm Mark Eastcheck.
And I'm Andrew Whately.